It's our distance limestone unseen gesture and circle. And I was particularly drawn to the word limestone because my father was a sculptor, and also because I enjoy writing responses to works of art. So I chose Barbara Hepworth's sculpture, Monolith Imperium, which she carved in 1953 as a memorial to her son, John Skeeping, who'd been killed that same year while on active service in the with the RAF. There's a photograph taken in 1954 of Hepworth at a retrospective exhibition of her work, where she is looking up at this monument, and it's as much this photograph and the expression on her face as the sculpture that I've tried to capture in the poem. Monolith. This dark shadow of a monument stands in vigil stillness, abstract in form, emotion lithified, but gesturing to an upward gaze, as though she wanted always for it to search the skies, when she could not. She draws her eyes, of course, to the middle distance and through its narrow opening, the space between embracing figures, an impassable door, or atrophic scar, and above it, a smaller circle like a dark-rimmed eye, half-closed and sunken, its glint almost unseen, but not forgotten. Knowing in her autumn years that her tears for his lost spring would not dissolve this limestone pillar, she chipped and chiselled out a solid future for their fragile past, and finding deep in the seasonless landscape of her grief, first fault, then form. That I wrote for the 2018 Poets Meet Politics competition. It was written in response to the events of the 11th of November 1918, and one event in particular. At the same time as the bells of Shrewsbury Abbey rang out to announce the armistice, Mr. and Mrs. Owen, who lived in the town, received a telegram to inform them that their son Wilfred had been killed in action just 7 days before. This poem's called The Lich Bell, which is Lich Bell's traditionally rung as a funeral procession approaches the church. How the November rain clouds hung like a grey blanket from early in the afternoon, half muffling the abbey bells. How I nearly missed the familiar jangle of our own. How the boy stood, eyes downcast and hand outstretched. The endless moment before the envelope passed. My tongue sound as a rasp against the dry chamber of my mouth. How he turned and ran. How I watched his diminishing figure until the mist claimed him. The cacophony in my head. The audible thud of my heart on the walls of my chest. The slow gasp of breaking seal and folded sheet drawn out. How our eyes swung back and forth repeatedly from printed word to slanted script. The failure to resonate. How we stood in silence. The constant bombardment of change ringing all around us. How the Lich Bell was the only one we heard. This poem was written in a response to a poem by Ted Hughes called Big City, which he wrote in turn after a dream he'd had about Sylvia Plath, where he was pursuing her through the city. And it's called Out of the City. I'm glad you took us out of the city when you did. From all those high roads and brake shrieking hackney cabs, from route master rumblings, the clack clack of surface railways, the whine of the underground and aircraft sighing slowly over the haze of exhaust fumes and chimney smoke hanging above it all. If we had stayed, where would I find my poems now? In the narrow spaces between the tower block and the terrace, in the ranks of identical bicycles slanted by the station, gaps in the cafe chains or flickers of light in all those heavy-eyed hotels. Instead of knowing the words of birdsong or finding lines in the striations of petals or whispered by trees, I'd read the tags of graffiti or pick up throwaway lines from the gutter, find some iridescence in the oily rainbows arcing across the tarmac. I might trawl fresh ideas from the sameness of the river, pound for gold in light reflected under piers and bridges, find resonance in the church bells and clock chimes, or a rhythm in the iambic pentameter of trains crossing points. I could trace each changing statement of the skyline and rewrite it in a plainer text, block out the shifting silhouettes against the polluted blue of the night sky, then, by dawn, be the one light still shining, the dying candle I once held out for you. Many times over the last few years, we've woken in the morning to hear the results of life-changing events that have unfolded overnight, wars, elections, referendums, etc., etc. But whatever seems to happen to us, in the natural world, it's always just business as usual, and it's this poem's response to that, and it's called Unbroken. Remember that morning's slow introduction through frames of pale daylight? How the sad sweet song of a robin opened for the dawn chorus. How the sun seeped in through cracked curtains to slake the park darkness like whiskey dumped straight through a straw. We were hungry for news that morning, which seemed so long to come. And when at last, exactly on the hour, the clock radio sprang into life, even the pip seemed to sound like the slowed down alarm call of a blackbird. Then, as the knelling tones of the newsreader carved the moment in stone. Outside, the day just got on with itself, as it always will. The continuity of time, the sly shift of the seasons, and all of that life we have the arrogance to dismiss as not sentient, unstopping in its quest for survival, while we stumble on, evolved as we are, never to live in the moment, but only to anticipate the next. Yet always, always, to remember that morning, the unbroken birdsong, the breaking news. And the last one I'm going to read is basically about why I'm here, quite literally. Just over 220 years ago, my three times great grandfather was born right here in Cork. And as a young man, he travelled to England and settled in Hertfordshire. He didn't make his fortune there, but he did raise a large family, and I'm descended through his daughter, Catherine, who married Smith. So this is for John Neal, my three times great grandfather. He set sail on a single ticket, the man who brought my DNA from west of Ireland to England's east in the early 1800s. I imagine his baggage was just the clothes he wore, his dreams already stowed deep in the hold of his heart, this poor and thin young man who'd been in flight mode for a while. And I wonder if the rough seas might have looked to him like storm clouds as he fought both seasickness and homesickness with hopes that rose and fell in rhythm with the vessel's heave. Where he landed, how he travelled, and why he went to Buntingford, all things we may never come to know. But occupation, pauper, a census century later, holds out before our ever-eager eyes a tempting remnant of a clue. We do know that he couldn't read or even write his name, nor could his Hertfordshire bride, from the record of their marriage, signed by each with just a fragile X. But those two marks combined to set a double helix spiralling down so many decades through my father into me. And now, each time I fly to Ireland's west, I like to think I take John back here with me, try to see this homeland through those eyes, and hope that with my voice and through these words I leave here, he can feel a resonance and the sense of a successful journey's end.